The descriptions of wildfire seem to gain detail over time. And maybe that's because many more people are exposed to wildfire over time. To help us understand fire behavior and how that behavior corresponds to weather and climate, we turn to Craig Clements, who's the director of the Fire Weather Research Laboratory and an assistant professor in the Department of Meteorology at San Jose State University. Thanks for joining us today.
Hi, great to be here.
So tell us about the laboratory itself. Has it been around for very long?
Yeah, we started back in about 2011, and we have a unique capability at San Jose State. We're the only meteorological team in the U.S. Qualified to take instruments on wildfires. So the whole team is Fireline qualified. We work with CAL FIRE and the U.S. Forest Service to maintain our qualifications, and we generally get out on wildfires and perform observations with the Doppler LiDAR, which is like a radar. So it's kind of a unique situation capability.
Well, I was going to ask you about the tools of the trade, because laboratory implies some enclosed space, but it sounds like you really take the laboratory outdoors.
Yeah, we're basically an observational team. We go outside. We have a truck that's all mounted with equipment, and we do this some laboratory work when we sample fuels. We also monitor a lot of the fuels, which I'll probably be talking about today. And we bring those back in the lab where we dry them, weigh them, and calculate the fuel moisture content, which is actually a real critical aspect of wildfire behavior and analysis.
I noticed that part of it for sure. You do have some real movable parts here, like CSU maps. Tell us what that is.
Oh, yeah. So it's a California State University Mobile Atmospheric Profiling System. It's basically a four-wheel drive Ford pickup that's equipped with the equipment to launch weather balloons. We have internet. We have communications and also the Doppler LiDAR, which is a laser-based radar. And that allows us to peer through the fire plume and measure the wind circulations around the fires.
Which raises the question, again, I want to come back to the founding in 2011. Was the lab created in part because of the fact that wildfire behavior was getting more extreme, particularly in California?
Well, it was actually just part of it's the research I do. I'm only doing wildfire and fire weather research. My PhD was in that. And so I came back to California, where I grew up, and started a fire weather research program at San Jose State, where I also teach those classes and curriculum.
You know, it's one of those things where as you get further into the subject matter, which has always contained some fascination for me personally, you start to notice terms that you didn't notice before and notice that everybody in the business uses them. One of those is boundary layer profiling. And I've just noticed this in fire weather reports the last couple of days. What is that about?
So the atmospheric boundary layer is the closest layer of the atmosphere to the Earth. It's basically about a mile deep. So a little bit less most of the time. So it's the layer that the atmosphere can actually feel the effects of the Earth, let's say. So where the shear, where there's like turbulence and where all the pollution gets trapped. And above that, we consider that the free atmosphere, where like smoke plumes and pollutants can pretty much travel longer distances because of the upper level wind. So when we say boundary layer, it's just the layer of the air closest to the Earth's surface where most of the turbulence occurs and a lot of our local wind circulations occur.
And so the winds are different above that boundary layer?
Yeah, a lot of times you can have winds going the opposite direction. So within the boundary layer, it's where we get our mountain valley circulation. So at night, you're familiar with winds coming down the valley, where that cool air is blowing down the valley. And then during the day, they go up the valley generally. And that's within the boundary layer. Above that layer, you can have what we call like synoptically driven winds, which is mostly the larger scale winds that are blowing they're associated with a larger scale weather pattern. So it's decoupled, where the winds are closest to the surface are blowing maybe one direction, and their response is due to heating and cooling of the land. And these are the things that impact the fire behavior. The winds aloft usually are what blows the smoke into certain areas, but it's the local circulations that affect the fire behavior.
So the winds can be affecting the people on the ground fighting the fire and from one direction, and then the smoke is going to go a different direction once it gets up high?
Oh, yeah. You can see that in a lot of the pictures on Twitter, on the internet, from the current fires, where you see the plume going in a different direction than what's happening at the surface. And when you add a plume in the fire itself, you get what we call fire-induced circulations, which are very localized to the fire itself. And they're blowing in different directions based on the forcing mechanisms and the buoyancy of the fire itself.
We have many more questions for Craig Clements, the director of the Fire Weather Research Laboratory and an assistant professor in the Department of Meteorology at San Jose State University. You can join the conversation on the exchange. You might have some thoughts of your own about things you've always wanted to know about fire weather and what goes on out there. Join us on the exchange at 800-838-3760 by phone. Our email address is jx@jeffnet.org. I was hearing one of the meteorologists actually on one of the TV stations in Reading last night describing as the fire marched in toward town about convection, which I think a lot of us know about and leads to thunderstorms on hot parts of the summer if there's moisture in the atmosphere. But talk about, if you would, the general concept of convection and then what happens in a large fire.
So generally, convection is when we think about it in terms of atmospheric dynamics. The sun heats the Earth's surface. You warm that air, it becomes less dense, and so it rises because it's less dense and warmer. So it goes up, and if it's moist, it'll form a cloud, and that's our basic convective circulation. And as that air moves up, air returns down below it and flows into that gap or low that was, you know, where there's no more air mass. And so that's the basic circulation for cloud development and such. When we look at convection of a fire, you know, we think about the hot surface of the Earth. You know, say you're standing on the street and you can feel that temperature about 100 degrees Fahrenheit, maybe 150 if you're wearing your bare feet there. That's a real warm temperature compared to the atmosphere. But when you think, compare a fire, fire is about 1,000 to 2,000 degrees. It's about 1,000 degrees C. So about, say, 1,800 to 2,200 degrees Fahrenheit, much hotter, so much more convective. And so you've got rising parcels of air and gases that are racing vertically through the atmosphere. So it's very dynamic and very vigorous. And so as that happens, because of the fire, you get air rushing into it. And it depends on how the fire is moving and the fire behavior itself and where that air moves in. A lot of times it moves behind the fire front and helps propagate the fire front. So it's very interesting. So the convective fire, the convective processes of the fire itself help spread it.
So it really contributes to its own growth.
Yeah, and that's where this term, like the fire created its own weather, that's really where people say that, and it's because of the local circulations around the fire front. You know, the winds are, let's say, blowing from the north, but all of a sudden you have winds blowing from the south rushing into the fire when a few minutes earlier, they weren't blowing that way. So it's and we can't forecast fire-induced winds. We don't know how the fire and the atmosphere are going to respond. We can observe them barely. We can barely observe those. It's a unique atmospheric condition that we don't know a lot about.
I imagine it would be difficult to design instruments that would, A, let you get close enough, and B, survive the fire to be able to do the measurement you'd need to do.
Yeah, we rarely put standard weather station anemometers, you know, the spinning cups or the propeller-looking instruments. We use remote sensing tools like radar and this LIDAR, which is a wind LIDAR. So it measures the winds at different, we can scan just like a radar across the fire and look at how the winds are interacting with the fire front. And so that's what we usually do when we go to a wildfire, is be able to scan that. However, the distance that you can measure from is about maybe a mile. So you have to be within a mile of the fire. And it's difficult to get that close if you're a research team.
But when you have gotten close enough to get some measurements, what have you found out?
Well, you can see a lot of things that the winds are about three times greater than the ambient wind. And these are observations from some of our field experiments where we actually set instruments in the field and we let a fire run through the instrumentation. And then also from our LIDAR and wildfires, we see that the ambient winds, let's say they're 10 miles an hour. Well, the fire-induced winds could be 30 miles an hour. And so if you have a 30-mile-an-hour wind near the fire front, that's a different story than just a 5 to 10-mile-an-hour wind in terms of how the fire is going to propagate and how it's going to behave.
Craig Clements is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange, an assistant professor in the Department of Meteorology at San Jose State University and the director of the Fire Weather Research Laboratory based there. You can join the conversation on the exchange. We have lots of things we still have to learn about fires, and obviously, I guess he does too, but he's got a lot more under his belt. Join the conversation on the exchange if you'd like, 800-838-3760 to come in by phone. Our email address is jx@jeffnet.org. It does seem like people are learning a few more terms terms as the years go by, the pyrocumulus, or the big plume of smoke that comes up, particularly from a very active fire, is people getting used to photographing those and knowing the terminology about them. What is going on that makes that? Because it looks like a, you know, big old thunderhead.
Yeah, so it's a new and emerging field of research within fire weather and the wildfire community. But generally, just like a cloud, let's take the fire out and think about just the surface of the earth with no fire. If you have moisture in the air and you lift that air mass that's moist, and as it gets cooler, it's going to condense and form cloud droplets. And that's what you're seeing is in a cloud. You're seeing the cloud droplets. So you're seeing the moisture that has condensed. So if you take a fire and you lift that parcel up, and if there's any moisture in the atmosphere or in the plume itself, you're going to form a cloud as well. And because that cloud formed over the fire and on the smoke plume, we call it a pyrocumulus. If it gets more vigorous and deeper, we call that a pyrocumulonimbus, which is a thunderstorm. So generally what we see are pyrocumulus, very deep pyrocumulus clouds. And, you know, they can get into the stratosphere. And then that's where they inject smoke, and that smoke and then can go all around the globe. But one thing we don't know about, and that's something that we've been working on with some of our observations, is where's the moisture coming from? Is it moisture that's caused by the combustion of the fuels, the brush, the trees? Because, you know, they're living and they have water content in them. Is that the source of the moisture causing the cloud? Because some fires don't always have a pyrocumulus. Or is it ambient moisture? And generally our thought is it's the ambient moisture in the atmosphere that is being entrained into the plume. So it's being kind of sucked into the smoke column. And as it gets lifted, that water vapor now isn't condensing. So it's a complicated thing. We don't know the microphysics, what we call microphysics of the clouds. We don't know the microphysics of pyrocumulus very well either. So it's a unique research topic.
Which is endlessly fascinating to me, and I could probably just spend the whole day on pyrocumulus. But so is it? I mean, we've talked about the fact that you can get to the point where there's a new thunderstorm created by this cloud if it gets tall enough. Can it actually rain on itself? I mean, if there were, yeah. Obviously you can, really.
Yeah. No, it's been documented in what was it, Texas, I believe, last spring, where a pyrocumulonimbus formed and it started raining. So there, you can get precipital water, what we call precipital water, out of the cloud. So you can get rain. It's not common. It's not common.
All right. But
one, just, another. Oh, go ahead.
Go ahead. Go ahead.
And another unique thing is we had the opportunity to fly an aircraft through a pyrocumulus in Idaho in 2016, and to sample it to get some of the microphysics properties with some tools that are on the aircraft, and they also had a radar on the aircraft. That's what we're really interested in, looking how strong these updrafts. And what we found is the updrafts we found a maximum updraft of 58 meters per second, which is about 120 miles an hour.
Wow.
So the updrafts, the winds inside these smoke plumes are extreme. And so you're putting a lot of energy up into the atmosphere.
All right. So that explains why they get so tall. I mean, that is air mm-hmm. moving really fast in there. Okay.
Yeah.
So I want to come back to you talked about the fuel sampling program you do, and I wonder what the trend has been like in recent years, what the sampling shows you in fire fuels. And this is in California primarily, in the Bay Area primarily, isn't it?
Yeah. There are some sites up in the Shasta area. Generally, fuel sampling is a lot of labor. You have to have somebody go out, and it's like gardening. You clip the brush, and we use chamise and manzanita as our fuel types because they're very common. Chamise is common throughout the whole state, so it's kind of the standard. And so once to twice a month, you basically drive out to a site and you clip a little paint can full of tips of brush. And you get new growth and old growth, and then you take it back into the lab, and then you weigh it and dry it. And basically drying it, you just bake it for 24 hours at 100 degrees C or so. And that dries it out. And then you can then reweigh it, and you're just weighing the mass of the wood, woody particles and such. And so you can calculate how much water was in there. And that gives us the live fuel moisture content. And so these sites are all around. And what we're seeing is that we're about average, but some areas are below average. And it just depends. I was just looking at the area near Whiskey Town and the car fire, and a lot of the fuel moisture contents are below average there, well below average. So that's the live fuel moisture. And then we also have the dead fuel moisture. And these are the dead logs and the dead brush pieces that are laying on the ground. And those are actually in critical condition right now for Northern California and Southern Oregon.
You mean that low in moisture?
Yeah, they're very, very low. We have, and the way we classify those is we have the 10-hour fuel, the 100-hour fuel, and the 1,000-hour fuel, and those are size class. So a 10-hour fuel is a stick that's about as thick as your finger. And so it takes 10 hours for that stick to either absorb or dry out, absorb moisture or dry out, depending on the environmental conditions. If it rained, if there's a lot of soil moisture, if the humidity increases or decreases. So it's a 10-hour lag. So we call that a 10-hour fuel class. And that's a dead stick, like a dead fuel. The 100-hour is 1 to 3 inches. And so that's a little bit bigger stick, kind of a log. And then the 1,000-hour is an 8-inch log. And so these things are hard to measure, to get the right kind of log, to get it automated and stuff. It's not practical. So what we do is we go out and collect these things, cook them again, and then dry them and get the fuel moisture content of the dead fuels. And the big thing is the National Fire Danger Rating System, and that calculates these fuel classes as well. So that's how we get an idea of like where the fire danger is.
And that number, and for the national numbers, have those been generally trending toward the drier in recent years?
Yeah. So like today, basically just west of the National Fire Danger Rating, we call it NFDRS, is got extreme for west of Redding, and extreme in south of Monterey and the counties down there, just along the coast. Whereas the higher Sierra Nevada is low to moderate. High and moderate. So it just depends on the fuels and the weather conditions, and it's calculated daily. Sometimes it's calculated hourly. And so that's how we generally understand, like, ooh, today's going to be a high fire danger day, so if anything gets ignited, it could burn very rapidly, or the fire behavior could be extreme because the fuels are so dry.
Right, which we have certainly seen the last couple of days with the car fires mm-hmm. that moved from Whiskeytown Lake right into the city of Redding. Craig Clements is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange, the director of the Fire Weather Research Laboratory and an assistant professor in the Department of Meteorology at San Jose State University. A couple of things that happened in fires in recent years. Of course, you know, Redding is now being compared with last year's Tubbs Fire, the Napa-Sonoma fires. Mm-hmm. There were things that I didn't even know could happen. Like, what made the temperatures get so high in the middle of the night in Napa-Sonoma last year?
Well, that was probably associated. We've been actually analyzing that case. What happens is you get dry air with a north wind event, or a Diablo wind, what we call Diablo winds, mostly in the Bay Area, but they're considered more north winds in Northern California. It's basically nearly the same circulation. What happens is dry air moves over from the Great Basin down over the Cascades and the northern Sierra Nevada. And as it descends, it's dry. It dries out. And if you have, let's say you're in a coastal area like Napa, or, you know, coastal mountain ranges there, they're generally not too dry. Once that wind hits the ridgetops, it's forced downward, and then we call that a downslope wind storm. And so you get a little bit of drying because you're bringing air downward, so it expands, warms, and dries. But generally, you're bringing warmer air and drier air to the surface from upper elevations, actually. And that's what that causes. It's very localized. It's not like a whole region of drying.
All right. So the interaction of fires with the atmosphere. I noticed the National Weather Service here talks in terms of smoke keeping temperatures below their forecast highs, and that's not even right in the fire zone. And then firefighters talk about smoke as keeping something like a cap on the fire. I mean, have you observed these sorts of effects yourself?
Yeah. So it's quite a unique phenomenon when you what we call smoke shading. You have a layer of smoke that is very thick, let's say, and it's you know, above the ground, maybe 1,000 to 2,000 feet, and you have this very thick layer of smoke. Well, it's just like a cloud where the sun can't penetrate the cloud. And so the sunlight coming through the smoke is reduced, and so that doesn't warm the surface of the earth as well. So it keeps the temperatures cooler. In addition, that can actually, what we found, and we found this on the Eiler Fire last in the Bald Fire in 2014 up in Lassen County, where the smoke layer moved opposite direction of the ambient wind. And so we call that a smoke-induced density current, where the air is more dense because it's shaded under the smoke layer. And because it's more dense, it can move as a wind. And so we had a smoke layer propagating 10 miles in the opposite direction that it should have. So it can actually change the circulations around a fire. When you think about this capping inversion and the smoke capping, that's really smoke getting trapped in an already present inversion layer that's over the western U.S. We have a subsidence. If you have a high-pressure ridge, it gives a sinking air. And so that is what we call subsidence inversion. And that basically traps a lot of the smoke just within the boundary layer.
So just a couple seconds left here to get a fairly big thing covered, which is that is fire behavior changing as things get drier, as the world gets warmer?
Yeah, we're actually seeing that. And you're seeing all these fires in California. We're getting extreme interactions between the wildland and urban interface, where fires are burning into communities more often. And if we look back at the fire behavior triangle, it has three components. One is the topography. So if you have mountainous terrain, the fires burn more vigorous and faster upslope than they would on flat terrain. And then the other component is the fuels, and the other component is the wind. So you have terrain, fuels, and weather. So if the fuels are drying in a changing climate because it's getting warmer and the fuels are, and we're having more drought, that affects the fuel conditions. So that's the component of the fire behavior triangle that actually is being affected by climate change.
Right.
The fuels are changing.
All right. So much more we could ask about. We'll have you back at some point. Craig Clements is the director of the Fire Weather Research Laboratory at San Jose State University. Thank you so much.
Sure. Thanks for having me.